Live from Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Duncan, sitting in for Randall White. Cap Radio and Valley Vision have been conducting a survey of Sacramento area residents on how the pandemic has affected them. The results were released this week and show, among other things, that the majority of parents are stressed by having to balance their children's schooling, work, and home lives. You can find the full results of the survey online at capradio.org. This has spurred a larger conversation about a return to in-person learning sooner rather than later. Dr. Alix Gallagher is a state education policy expert and is the director of the Strategic Partnerships at Policy Analysis for California Education. She joins us now to help us understand the necessity of in-person learning. Welcome to Insight.
Thank you, Beth.
So let's just start with the biggest challenges that we're facing in K-12 education at this point in the pandemic.
Well, I think there are a lot of them. And one of the most important is that people are starting to realize that schools serve a much larger role in our society than just providing academic support for our kids. They are places where our students go to interact with friends and learn all of the non-academic skills that they're going to need to succeed. And they're also places that kids go so their parents can re-enter the workforce. And right now we're seeing that among the people who are not re-entering the workforce right now, a lack of childcare is one of the reasons that people cannot go back even if they would have jobs.
So what should parents be thinking about if their district is asking them, you know, choose between distance only and hybrid or in-person instruction?
Yeah, I think that's a really difficult call because those are our options for when your kids go back to school, but they don't actually tell you some of the things you need to know as a parent. The things that are most important in terms of supporting students are that the learning opportunities they get offer opportunities for them to receive information, like through reading a book or being, you know, listening to a lecture, to actively engage with that new information, new skills, potentially practicing it, and also to interact with other peers as well as a teacher around that information. And the different models that are offered, parents are rarely given information about how high quality instruction will be provided within those. And we know from research that it's actually possible in all of those structures to provide opportunities for students to interact with each other and have really promising ways of engaging with new content. And so the choices we are being given have to do with schedule, but across the board, we don't really have a way of understanding as parents which of those ways of scheduling students will give our students the best educational opportunities.
Can you expand a little bit on the research that you mentioned?
Yeah. One of the issues first as a disclaimer is that very little research has yet been able to be conducted with people trying distance or hybrid learning at scale. This is new because of the pandemic, and the research base tends to be rooted in older students and in situations where students and teachers were opting for online. But there is a really strong research base on a model called a flipped classroom, where students asynchronously or independent of each other in terms of time, take opportunities to bring new information in and then practice that. And one example we've become increasingly familiar with is Khan Academy videos, where you see a demonstration of a new skill and kids do some practice problems. Kids then in that flipped model go into classrooms where they get to interact with each other and a teacher to figure out which areas they didn't understand well and have those original misconceptions corrected, and to really collectively go deeper to explore proofs. Why does this work? When does it work? When does it not work? And really have those types of enriching discussions across a range of academic content areas that builds deep knowledge and helps students learn things like, how do I politely engage when I disagree? So it's a mix of the social and academic depth that you can get from that model. It's not the only model for high quality instruction, but it definitely is one. And I think one of the challenges parents are facing is that school districts have not yet been able to invest time in really figuring out and supporting teachers to choose a pedagogical model that will work for the structures they have. And it's a big shift for a lot of teachers. So it would be really beneficial if teachers had the time and supports to find high quality resources and learn how to use them well in whatever structure for school is in place.
And so let's turn to the actual effects of screen time. And when our kids are required to be on Zoom all day, what are we thinking about the potential of that and what kind of effects it'll have on the kids?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And again, the answer is really beneath that surface of the amount of time. We know that the traditional screen time guidance that has come out of a variety of national organizations are based on an understanding of screen time as something very passive, a kid sitting and passively watching TV or playing a game by him or herself. It's not an engaged type of screen time. But when you think about the range of ways screen time can be used, it's very different if a kid is using a screen to have a conversation with their grandparents across the country, or in the classroom setting to have a discussion with other members of the classroom community. So I don't think we have particularly many worries about the amount of time that students might spend actively engaged and interacting, mediated by screen and video and Zoom. The concern is much greater when what students are being asked to do is listen to long lectures for class after class and passively attempt to receive information for hours at a time. And there really is nothing to suggest that that would be particularly effective. And for any of the listeners who themselves find themselves in Zoom meetings for hours at a day, you know that by the end, your chances of being able to fully process and learn are pretty nil. And so I think that's the area that we have to think about, not how much screen time, but what that screen time is used for.
Aside from the academics, 53% of parents responding were very concerned about the loss of, you know, other services schools provide, school lunches, counseling. How can you respond to that?
Yeah, I think that goes back to one of my original points about the range of things that schools provide. And I think it's a real challenge that the way our state has rolled out their response to this crisis, the way it's unfolded, is that we're asking school leaders to figure out things like how many masks are they going to need each day? How should they set up rooms with what type of plexiglass dividers? And we are also at the same time asking schools to make sure kids have food, their basic needs met. And we hear from educators across the state how in the past they've been able to, through informal interactions, see how kids are doing, check in on their mental health, have kind of informal conversations where they hear even about serious issues like abuse. None of those things are available in traditional ways. And schools' plates are really full. Suddenly schools are also trying to figure out how to get hotspots and devices in quantities that are necessary to support distance learning out. And those challenges are real. I think schools are rising to them. They're making really good efforts, and we are making strides forward. But sometimes that comes at the expense of schools being able to centrally invest in resources that would help teachers provide high quality instruction. We can't get more out of schools while we are asking them to spend more of very restricted budgets on other things. And so that's a systemic statewide and federal problem that needs to be solved.
And digging in a little more to the CAP Radio Valley Vision poll, the poll also found that 57% of parents with school-aged children wanted schools to reopen in some form. So here are some quotes from parents who participated in our survey, and I'll ask you for your reaction to them. My 2-year-old son is home with me full time, so I'm stretched thin with full time work and care.
I have 2 coworkers right now who will shortly be logging into distance learning, and I'll just say I can relate. Mine are not 2, which is a really good thing for me. But there are definitely real challenges. I've seen studies out that suggest that parents on average are spending 6.5 hours supporting, not per day, per week, supporting students. And that's higher than before. Not to mention the fact that we are all familiar with the Zoom bombings that happen. The idea of trying to work full time from home or find alternate childcare for your kid while your smaller kid is engaged in school, and sometimes having older siblings trying to do their own school while supporting younger ones. It's it shows, I think, how our society has failed. We are not doing the things we need to do societally to take care of kids, which is putting a real stress on our entire education system.
I love this next one because we all know how it is to deal with teenagers, right? Keeping my 16-year-old motivated to do distance learning is wrecking my whole life.
Mine is 15. So I think that's about all I need to say. I won't quite say wrecking my whole life, but I have more empathy than I wish I did.
All righty. Well, we appreciate you being with us so much this morning. That is Dr. Alix Gallagher, a state education policy expert, and she is the director of strategic partnerships at Policy Analysis for California Education. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
And again, you can find the COVID-19 resilience poll on our website right now at capradio.org. Well, technology has played an integral role during the pandemic, no more so than in education and in distance learning. Adults and kids alike are spending more time with their tech, and screen time, as we talked a little bit about, is increasing for everyone across the board. For more on that, we welcome Dr. Andy Jones. He is a faculty member at UC Davis, academic director of Academic Technology Services, and editor-in-chief of the UC Davis Instructional Technology blog. Welcome to Insight.
Good morning, Beth. Thank you so much.
So simply, how has technology helped us continue with work and school in most cases?
Well, at UC Davis, it's been foundational and necessary that we all continue to interact, support each other, do the work of the university. For me, that means inspiring students in a classroom. I'm teaching a journalism class this quarter. And trying to kind of capture some of what Dr. Gallagher was saying about harnessing interaction, building a community, focusing on the content that needs to be communicated, setting up rich assessments and essay assignments for my students, all while looking at a series of Brady Bunch-like boxes. So it's a challenge for them and a challenge for me as a faculty member. But of course, all of us at UC Davis have shifted over to online instruction. We've all been thrown into the deep end of the pool at the same time. And so we have been engaging in lots of activities to support each other, to investigate innovative ways of harnessing these tools. And I think because of that, many of us no longer can teach on automatic pilot, no matter how well we know our subject. And I think that the pedagogy is improved and the organization of our classes has improved in a great number of ways.
How would you define screen time?
Well, there's obligatory screen time and the screen time that we engage in voluntarily. And I think the screen time for the students at UC Davis, that primarily means Zoom when we're connecting with students synchronously. As Dr. Gallagher said, many of us at UC Davis are creating lectures that we upload that students can watch over and over again. And then we use our time together to interact, to form a community, to have conversations about important class topics. So all of this requires screen time. I think that the Zoom fatigue we all feel is often exacerbated by the isolation that we also feel if we're staying safe. And that means that we're spending a lot of time, watching Netflix or doing interactive video gaming or spending time on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram. And so that the kind of social needs that we have are so important, but we've had to use these different forms of mediation in order to engage in those needs or to distract us from our isolation. And I think we're all becoming exhausted and frazzled, much like one of those parents of two-year-olds who you were quoting
yes.
earlier.
How can parents, speaking of them, manage their screen time as well as their kids?
Well, like Dr. Gallagher, I have a 15-year-old who's in class right now about 10 yards from me. I also have a 22-year-old and a 19-year-old who are all in Zoom classes right now, while my wife runs a support group for new moms also on Zoom also right now. So it's kind of integral to much of the work that we do. We have to figure out how we're going to spend our time when we step away from all of that. Often we would go to the gyms or the bars or the movies, and those options are not really available to us. But we are lucky to live in California. We have beautiful weather here in October now that the skies have cleared. And so, you know, one thing that I've done, and I've seen a lot of my colleagues in the city of Davis do, is just take advantage of our parks and green belts and head out there with our kids, get some exercise. I think it's probably too much to ask to leave our phones at home, but just to, you know, look at far horizons and notice trees and hold a kid's hand while walking through a park. All those things that we used to enjoy in the 19th century without thinking about it, many of them are still available to us as long as we can turn off our laptops and pocket our smartphones.
You know, one school we know of here in Sacramento decided to give Mondays off to kids, students, give them a break. Do you like that idea?
That sounds glorious. There's always a tension between what some faculty have called the tyranny of coverage, right? There's so much that has to be covered if we're going to prepare students for the next class or the next year in school, versus the sort of mental health, not only of our students, but the teachers who teach them and the parents who are trying to convince them to stay focused on their lessons. I think that Mondays off and other forms of time off would be important. I think we all need to acknowledge how strange this is for our students, what we ask of them. So I think that the mental health of everyone in this equation should be an important priority.
Yesterday, I spoke with Sac State President Robert Nelson, and he said that distance learning, even after the pandemic is over, will provide more opportunity and flexibility. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely. I think our faculty have discovered, because they've been forced to, a number of tools and approaches that they're really enjoying and that they're going to hold on to as they move forward. One for me, for example, would be instant office hours that I offer students. If a student emails me with a complex question, I will just say, well, let's jump into a Zoom call right now and discuss it. And of course, that sort of frictionless communication with our educators would not be possible almost any other way. In the classes where I teach, there's always a class coming into my classroom after mine. But now with Zoom, my 10:30 class ends officially at noon. But if I set up my schedule correctly, I can hang out with students who have questions, who need extra help for an additional hour. Yesterday was an hour and a half. And I think that that's often where I'm doing some of my best instruction. So to the extent that these technologies give us more access to our students and allow us to be more present and available for students and to offer the sort of incidental learning experiences that Dr. Gallagher mentioned at the start, and that I think our students, you know, K-12, but also at the university level, they really miss that. If we can offer more of those without having to, say, bike into campus, then I think that that's a technology and an approach that will continue to serve us and our students for years to come.
Dr. Andy Jones is a faculty member at UC Davis, Academic Director of Academic Technology Services, and Editor-in-Chief of the UC Davis Instructional Technology Blog. We really appreciate you taking the time to share your thoughts with us this morning.
Thank you, Beth. This is a lot of fun.
Up next, Election Day is nearly here, 13 days to be exact, and Insight takes a closer look at tight races in some of California's most conservative districts. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Beth Duncan, in for Randall White.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Beth Duncan, in for Randall White. Democrats have controlled many aspects of California politics for years, but it's a different story in some pockets of the state, which have been Republican bastions for years. Nina Sparling is a contributing project reporter for CAP Radio. Nina has been reporting on races for the State House and Congress in some of California's most conservative districts. Nina joins us now. Welcome, Nina.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Tell us about these districts. Where in California have you been focusing?
Yeah, absolutely. So most of my reporting has been in the North State of California. So this is District 1 in the State Senate, the State Assembly, and also in the House of Representatives. And it's one of California's largest districts. It sort of stretches from the Nevada border across Shasta County, from Oregon, basically down to Lake Tahoe. And it's long been a Republican stronghold. And the demographic makeup here looks a little bit less than like what we typically think of as California, and a little bit more like rural Pennsylvania or the Midwest. And I think what really drew me to this area and to look at these campaigns more closely was Audrey Denny's campaign for Congress. This is her second run, and she's raised a lot of money, nearly double the amount of the incumbent, Representative Doug LaMalfa. And then I learned that she was a part of this kind of cohort of Democratic women who are running on this idea of bringing a new voice and a new direction to this part of the state.
And what are some of the issues that are most important to voters in that area?
Yeah, absolutely. So this year, especially, the pandemic has been hugely polarizing in many of these districts. It's also underscored a lot of infrastructure needs and kind of investment needs that have been lingering for a while. Chief among those is rural broadband. Internet access is really a struggle in a lot of areas here. A lot of families haven't been able to get online. So kids have been struggling. Students have been struggling to access education. This is also where the Zog Fire, which is now contained, but just burned over 56,000 acres. So forest management is a top line issue for candidates on both sides of the aisle. I think it's pretty clear that something's got to give, no matter who you talk to. I'd also throw in that access to medical care and rural health care is a big issue, and so is water. This is the headwater region for much of California's water supply, so things like water storage and water usage are big issues for people here. It's also, there's a lot of agriculture. There's a big ranching community in this part of California.
Yeah, so who are these challengers that have popped up in the past few cycles?
Yeah, absolutely. So I spoke to five women who are running for office from the State House to Washington, D.C., and they're all hoping to flip seats that have long been held by Republicans, two for State Assembly, one for State Senate, and then two for Congress. And essentially, these women are all basically moderate Democratic candidates who are trying to win over conservative or undecided voters who might be frustrated with the National Republican Party, with the sort of state of polarization we're seeing across the country. And I would also say that alongside that very strong Republican base, because there is a really strong Republican base that has embraced the president, there are also a lot of no party preference voters or more centrist Republicans who might not identify as strongly with the president and the direction that he's pulled the party and the country.
When Democrat and Chico resident Audrey Denny ran for Congress in 2018, she didn't expect to win. The First District is one of California's most conservative and stretches from the Nevada border across Shasta County in the far northern part of the state.
When I started running in 2018, like, this is a 33-year-old Democrat woman, first-time candidate, no experience, like, no one was going to take me seriously.
Denny always planned to run twice, once to get her name out and once to win. In both campaigns, she's been up against Congressman Doug LaMalfa, who doubts the human contribution to climate change and is a vocal opponent of same-sex marriage. LaMalfa also relies on corporations to finance his campaigns. Denny has built her campaign on what she frames as putting the interests of voters first.
And the farther along I've gotten in this journey, the Republican leadership in Washington, D.C. has sold people out. They work for the corporations that sponsor their reelections, and that's it.
Denny, who teaches agriculture, refuses corporate donations, but she's already outraised her opponent. And Denny says she wants to appeal to all voters by focusing on issues, not ideology.
Talking about healthcare, specifically rural healthcare, moves people. Talking about fire protection and forestry management moves people. Rural broadband moves people.
Political analysts say issue-driven campaigns can appeal to voters without strong party loyalty. And there are a lot of those voters in far northern California, says David McEwen. He chairs the political science department at Sonoma State.
They are folks that, in some ways, are just not as partisan, and they determine elections in a close election or a wave election.
But McEwen says for candidates like Denny, success doesn't just come from their campaign's ability to win over voters. It also depends on national political wins.
You start to see some edges here that could move, even in a safe Republican district, if there's some type of wave election that's built for Democrats nationally.
State Assembly hopeful Elizabeth Betancourt hopes Redding area voters will appreciate her focus on issues that affect rural people, like forest management and improving broadband access. Betancourt's a farmer and scientist by trade, so running for office is new for her.
Politics can be frustrating for folks like us who run because it's about, you know, name recognition. It's about money, and all of that is hard to get in a single race.
Betancourt is running for a second time against incumbent Republican Megan Daly. Like Denny, Betancourt has refused corporate donations and wants to get money out of politics. And amid a pandemic, wildfires, unemployment, and more, Betancourt hopes to bring some stability to the region.
Many of us are feeling just completely incapacitated because of the chaos that we see around us. To feel empowered to have a voice in what happens next in your region, that is what I'm interested in building.
Both Betancourt and Denny won significantly more votes in their last campaigns than previous Democrats running for the same seat. But their districts have been held by the GOP since 2012, and a win for either Democrat would be a marked political shift.
So, Nina, how are we seeing California Republicans approach this election cycle in this part of the state?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's tough for down ballot candidates in any presidential election year. So much attention and money gets directed towards the national races, which are obviously particularly high profile this year. And that means there just isn't as much time or energy that gets spent on more local races. But what was stood out to me in talking to some current state assembly representatives in this part of the state is how much they want to keep the focus on really local issues and on questions that their district is facing and questions that California is facing. There are, of course, aspects of their platforms and values that square pretty easily with the national GOP. So things like investing more heavily in law enforcement, strong defense of the Second Amendment. Some are also pro-life, things like this. But they do recognize to an extent how too much overt enthusiasm could alienate voters who aren't necessarily sympathetic to the president and the direction he's pulled the GOP. So you could say, in a sense, they're trying to create a California-specific identity for Republicans and do see that could be pretty essential to the future of the Republican Party in California.
Kevin Kiley wants Californians to think more about state politics. He represents Assembly District 6, which extends from Roseville into the Sierra foothills. Kylie says he wants to advance charter schools, address income inequality, and homelessness. But more than anything, Kylie wants to change the culture of the legislature.
Our legislative process doesn't have the sort of debate and discussion and public participation and weighing of the merits of an issue that you ought to have in a well-functioning democratic society.
Kylie says lobbyists and special interests hold way too much sway in Sacramento, and that drowns out the voices of more rural and conservative communities.
A lot of the frustration is when you have more and more power that's taken away from our local communities and is concentrated at the Capitol and then results in policies that don't reflect the values of our communities.
So Kylie wants to amplify rural and conservative voices by building a center-right coalition in California state politics, which would focus on issues like homelessness, infrastructure, and education.
So that's the sort of thing I've been trying to help contribute to. How can we build a platform for improving the quality of life of Californians, addressing these basic quality of life failings that everyone sees, and have that agenda be distinctly nonpartisan?
Although he's not loud about it, Kylie says building a center-right agenda means distancing himself from the National Republican Party. Mike Madrid has no problem saying California Republicans need to create their own identity. He co-founded the Lincoln Project last year, a coalition of conservatives working to unseat President Trump.
So the Republican Party has been a long time since it was an actual viable party in California. By and large, it's been on a decline for 25, 30 years.
Madrid says the GOP in California hasn't evolved to embrace the growing ethnic diversity in the state, but that hasn't alienated its base in northern and eastern parts of California, where the president won a majority of votes in 2016.
So these districts look a lot more like West Virginia or rural Alabama than they do what we stereotypically believe is California. The demographic cohort is essentially the same, and wherever that demographic exists in America, it's usually a red state.
Madrid warns California's GOP may be punished at the polls for sticking to its ways. But Republican State Assemblywoman Megan Daly says the party's traditional values are its strength. She represents District 1 from the Oregon border down to Lake Tahoe, and she's running again, touting the need for better forest management and internet access, which has come to the fore during the pandemic and recent wildfires.
Now the urgency is just amplified. We need broadband, but now we really need it. We can't wait another 10 years. We can't wait to study forest management. We need boots on the ground. We need our timber industry at the table.
Like Kylie, Daly thinks that recent crises could deepen and broaden support for Republicans this election. Many of her constituents are critical of how California has managed the COVID pandemic, and they're paying more attention to regional politics. Daly says her mindset is different from the political norm in Sacramento.
The one-size-fits-all doesn't work for the North State. And we just have a lot of issues up here that are different.
Daly says if she's reelected, she'll keep the focus local and try not to let the national GOP narrative dominate. She'd have to work within a Democratic majority in the state legislature to get something done. That's a balancing act other California Republicans will also be grappling with.
So, Nina, how are these candidates feeling about or approaching, let's say, or sparring with challengers from the left?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think what's interesting is that, yes, these are all Democratic challengers, but they are really approaching these races from a more moderate position. You could call them kind of business Democrats, if you will. We're not really talking about Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez type candidates at all. So candidates like Audrey Denny and Elizabeth Betancourt, they don't fit into that progressive wing of the Democratic Party. Audrey Denny was a registered Republican for years before she flipped a Democratic ticket. And so they're really trying to appeal to a set of voters, those no party preference voters, maybe some of the quote unquote never Trump Republicans in these districts. There are those voters, but these races are still a long shot. The incumbents I spoke to are, to put it bluntly, not concerned. They know that they have a registration advantage. Most registered voters, or the highest number of registered voters, are Republicans in these districts. And there is really quite strong support for the president in large swaths of this area of California. As I said, there isn't a lot of concern. One thing I thought was interesting is David McEwen, who is the political scientist at Sonoma State I spoke to, said that he thinks Bryn Kennedy's race in California's 4th congressional district is the most competitive. That district is a bit further south. It runs from kind of the area, Tahoe area, down to Fresno. And he says that Kennedy it's a long shot to win this cycle as a first-time candidate. She's running against Representative Tom McClintock. But he thinks that she could prevail if she doesn't this cycle, if she were to run again in 2022. He sees a real possibility there. So it's partly a numbers game, it's partly a time game. And I think the outcome for all of these candidates and all of these races will also depend a lot on what happens at the national level. It's hard to separate those two.
Lots of information to digest. Nina Sparling is a contributing reporter for CAP Radio. Thanks for joining us today, Nina.
Thanks for having me, Beth.
Still ahead, Believe. It's a new single from a trio of Sacramento women called Dear Darling, and it may just be the right song at the right time. Shoot us an email to insight@capradio.org. You can use the Twitter hashtag AskInsight. We'd love to hear from you. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Beth Duncan, in today for Randall White. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Beth Duncan, sitting in today for Randall White. Well, in this time when there's a lot going on around us, from politics to the pandemic, we at CAP Radio like to take a little time to offer our listeners a respite from the stress surrounding all of us. Today, Insight is delighted to introduce a new musical trio to our listeners. They are called Dear Darling, and they have just released their first single, Believe, a fitting title for the times that we're living in. The group includes seasoned musicians Casey Lipka, bass and voice, Hannah Jane Kyle, guitar and voice, and Natalie Hagwood, cello and voice. And we are happy to have them all with us, virtually, of course. Welcome to Insight, you guys.
Thank you so much for having us.
Congratulations on the release of Believe. That's really exciting. Casey, let's start with you. What's the history behind the name Dear Darling? How did you guys come up with the name? And also, how did you meet?
Oh, that's a great question. So first, I'll start with the name. We were together in January for a four-day retreat. We had our first official show on January 11th, and we said, we need a name. So we have 4 days to come up with the name. Here we go. And we were thinking about letter salutations, and we had some contenders, but we decided on Dear Darling, which I love that name, so I'm glad we settled on that. And let's see, how did we meet? I met Natalie about a year and a half ago, and Hannah shortly before that. I met both of them through music, and I said, hey, let's get together. And we did, and here we are, a year and a half later, a band and releasing a single.
Hannah, let's go to you. Describe Dear Darling's musical style. Now, you guys call it in your bio, entering into new sonic territory. That's one description. Can you elaborate on what that means?
Yes. So it's kind of a unique situation, in my opinion, because we all come from such different genres and different studies. Like, Natalie is a classically trained cellist, and Casey's been mostly jazz trained, where I have some musical theater background. So it's kind of like a blending, and we met in the middle with this folksy, theatrical, with this beautiful classical cello with jazz influences. It's this weird conglomerate of all three of our influences. And it comes out really sweet. Most of it is all sweet.
And what was the inspiration behind the song Believe, Hannah or Natalie? Yeah. Let's go to Natalie.
Well, I love that the three of us really care about the message behind our music. And I think it's really fitting that Believe is the first song we release, because I think a huge theme behind our music is to empower others, to empower women. And this song is the chorus words say, believe in yourself the way I believe in you. And it's about uplifting each other in music. And I think Hannah has some great words behind the meaning as well.
Hannah.
Thank you. Yeah. Casey and I had many conversations about what it's like to make a living as an artist and things that you have to sacrifice in order to, you know, go for what you want. And sometimes it's really easy, especially as young women, to get lost in what do I want to do? It's so nebulous and open. There are so many choices and trying to figure out the right direction to take with your music. But with both Casey and Natalie, having these two women who have been on similar paths and who also understand these feelings, I've found my drive again and my path again. So it was sort of like a friendship song with feeling lost, but being able to be found again in this situation. So.
Okay, in just a second, we're going to listen to a little bit of Believe. But before we do that, Casey, can you tell me the connection between all three of you in Sacramento? Are you Sacramentans or do you come from different parts of the country?
We are all in Sacramento. I'm currently in Los Angeles right now, but we are a Sacramento-based group. And I mean, obviously right now things are a little bit different, but our roots are in Sacramento, yes.
Let's listen to a little bit of Believe.
Walking along this unpaved road, I find myself far from home, chasing dreams and following my plans. Soles of my shoes are wearing thin, I don't think anyone's listening. If they did, then they'd understand. Keep some of the good for yourself. Hold on to all the good that's left. There's always a chance to stand and be true. Believe in yourself the way I believe in you. Believe in yourself the way I believe.
We're going to hear the whole song in just a few minutes, but we're going to talk a little bit more about the themes on your songs, like Believe, of self-empowerment, unconditional love, and following your dreams. Natalie, can you address that?
Absolutely. Meeting Casey and Hannah has been personally empowering for me. I feel so supported by the two of them musically and personally. We are all each other's cheerleaders in life and in music. I continually say I'm always pinching myself that I get to make music with Casey and Hannah and just have them as friends in my life as well.
Casey, walk us through how you collaborate on composing a song. I mean, I'm talking literally. Do you sit in a room when you used to be able to sit in a room together and construct it, you know, line by line, measure by measure, lyrics first, music next? What's the method?
Yeah, the method. Well, the short answer is that the method is always different, because we all contribute different things. We're three songwriters coming together, but we do have six golden rules that we live by, so to speak, which are leading with kindness, keeping an open mind, serving the song, embracing silly and ridiculous ideas, leaning into each other's strengths, and trusting and listening to each other. I think all of those things are immensely important to come together as collaborators, as songwriters, as people creating music.
Hannah, how do you guys right now, you know, you talk about tight harmonies and they are so beautiful. You guys sound like you're one voice. How do you do that in the midst of COVID-19? How do you rehearse?
Oh, gosh. Yes, we use a lot of digital platforms. Right now we've been using Logic, where we share a file, and then we each record into the same recording file, and that works really well. And we haven't been able to do much writing, but I'm sure, especially with Casey, because she's like the, I don't know, she dreams big and then somehow makes things happen. I'm sure Casey's going to figure something out to where we can be together and write together and have it be pretty seamless, pretty quick here. She's a miracle worker. But yeah, we've been able to record and do a couple videos, but in terms of writing, we gotta think on that.
So Casey, what are you guys working on right now since you're in this COVID-19 situation?
Yeah, we've got some exciting things coming very soon. If you're interested in finding out more, you can sign up for our top secret, you know, notifications on our website, deardarlingmusic.com. And we are working on an album as well. So
awesome.
We've got some things happening and some future plans. So get ready. Here we go.
And where can people find your music? Not only Believe, but other things that you've done, some videos and whatnot?
You can find all of that on our website, deardarlingmusic.com. And we are on all streaming platforms. So, yeah, that's where you can find our music.
Let's see. Let's go to Hannah real quick. Hannah, once again, as you guys are separated right now, how do you get inspiration to just continue under these circumstances?
Oh gosh, that's such a hard, it's been really hard. The first couple months, Dear Darling, we were like, okay, hang on, we've got to reposition ourselves and wrap our heads around this thing. So we kind of put our music on pause while we figured out our own lives and what we're going to do. And then when we came back together, we had a stronger vision. But something that definitely has kept me going personally is the entirety of Dear Darling with some friends. We do a daily songwriting group through Zoom every morning at 11:30. So I get to start my day looking at these beautiful faces. And one of us provides a prompt, and then we all mute and write. And that's really, really kept me going when I feel like, you know, sometimes it's easy to feel lost, like, what's the point of it all? But I think now more than ever, people need music. I know I do. So.
And so when someone sees you guys, maybe pre-COVID-19, says, who's in charge of this group anyway? Who's in charge, you guys? Casey?
Notice the silence. because we truly are 33% each. So it's a collaborative effort all the way.
Well, we want to thank the trio of Dear Darling for joining us on Insight today. Before we hear the song Believe, that is Insight for today. I'm Beth Duncan in for Randall White with producers Cynthia Lopez and Kyle McKinnon. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, Helga Salinas, and Megan Minata. Our technical director is Mark Jones. Our engineer is Antonio Munoz. Insight's managing editor is Aram Sarkissian. Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. Thank you for joining us. Enjoy, Believe, and have a wonderful rest of your day.
Walking along the sun-paved road, I find myself far from home, chasing dreams and following my plans. Soles of my shoes are wearing thin. I don't think anyone's listening. If they did, they'd understand. Keep some of the good for yourself. Hold on to all the good that's left. There's always a chance to stand and be true. I said when I was dreaming. Such a long way from the start. Along the way, I lost some heart to bitterness and a fear of failing. Keep some of the good for yourself. Hold on to all the good that's left. There's always a chance to stand and be true. Inside it. make a stand today. Don't let it break you, don't let it change you. I'm getting out of my own way. Don't let it break you, don't let it change you. I will make a stand today. Don't let it break you, don't let it change you. I'm getting out of my own way. Keep some of the good for yourself. Hold on to all the good that's left. There's always a chance to stand and be true.
Stand and be true.
Believe in yourself the way I believe in you. Believe in yourself the way I believe in you.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.